Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, most on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast, the place to be for six, seven and eight figure sellers, particularly if you're based in the UK, but not only, there's a lot of listeners to the amazing FBA, our sister podcast based in the America. And as the 10K Collective podcast develops, I expect there to be value on both sides of the pond. Talking of Americans, we've got one of the biggest thinkers in the Amazon space, a really sharp sort of street economist is the word I use about him, Will Churnland of Goat Consulting. Will is one of the, I guess, was one of the best known Amazon sellers around a while ago, former Amazon seller and vendor. Now he's a consultant at Goat Consulting. Goat Consulting is an Amazon agency specializing in brand management on Amazon. Pretty seriously insightful guy. So Will, fantastic to have you back on the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Oh yeah, thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about dealing with the competition off Amazon and offline, as well as the online thing. So obviously, we are all in a way hyper aware of competition, but the way in which we kind of analyze it and assess it, I think you have a pretty unique view on. So tell us a little bit more about your take on competition on Amazon in 2019 in the broadest strokes, and then we'll come back in to zoom in on some detail.
Yeah, traditionally, when I talk to someone within the Amazon bubble who kind of eats, sleeps, and breathes this stuff and goes to all the different Amazon conferences, they tend to be very, very focused on stuff like BSR when they're looking at competition, and they're trying to look at sales ranks, and they're really looking at those types of metrics, where I'm much more interested in kind of who the actual different sellers are, if they're Amazon selling the product, if it's a bunch of merchant fulfilled people, or if it's just a bunch of private labelers who have two products each, and really kind of deep diving into basically what's going on in the entire marketplace. Each listing kind of tells a story between seeing if the seller is selling a bunch of different products, see if all those products are optimized, see if anyone else is selling those products, or if they're the only brand owner of their products, and getting an idea of kind of how sophisticated their Amazon knowledge is before entering a niche, because there might be niches that you can put all the different stats into Viral Launch or Jungle Scout, and it might seem like the perfect niche to get into, but you have no idea really who you're competing with. If you're competing with some multinational brand that does billions of dollars in sales, it might not be a good thing to get into. On the other end, if you are dealing with some multinational brand that does billions of dollars in sales, it might be the perfect product to get into, because they have no idea what their individual customers want on Amazon. And so it's really thinking about things from a holistic point of view and thinking about kind of the psychology of the different sellers and what they're all trying to achieve with the Amazon marketplace. With our Amazon agency, we deal with a bunch of different brands that have us optimize their Amazon listings, but never have any intention of ever selling on Amazon. There's all sorts of kind of unique situations out there, and hearing from all the different types of sellers and vendors out there and all the different business models that they have on Amazon kind of builds my repertoire of knowledge of all the different ways people can make money on Amazon and ways to kind of fill in the gaps in the market.
Cool. So just to reflect back, I guess typically if you remember you saying to me that, you know, you did a, I think it's an economics degree, isn't it? But you just, you know, you couldn't quite bring yourself to do all the detailed analysis in sort of some of the dots in the I's and crossing the T's, but you do have quite a sort of holistic take on life, which is quite unique. And I think this is why I really, really wanted to talk to you about this subject. And it's so important because what you just pointed out that really, I guess, sometimes you can't see the wood for the trees, right? You look at all the numbers and people say the data doesn't lie, but it depends which bit of data you're looking at. If you're looking at one particular tree and the exact nature of the bark on that tree, you may not notice that the wood's on fire until you look around you, right? So very important point. So let's talk about, there's so many places to go with this, as it always is with you, it's a multifaceted conversation. Tell us a little bit about how you figure out who you're competing with first then. So you said that the nature of who you're competing with, multinational brands can actually be good people to compete with, which is an interesting thing. Let's start with that first. Multinational brands. Why is it good to compete with multinational brands? On the safer face of it, it looks a bit scary.
Because there's a bunch of different examples. So first and foremost, if you search for like AirPods on Amazon, we get some brand analytics. I'm pretty sure it's like AirPods, like the third or fourth most searched keyword on all of Amazon. And if you search AirPods right now from Apple, one of the large companies in the world, none of their listings are optimized. They don't even care about the Amazon sales channel because it's 3% of their total retail or something like that. And so when they're that big, they don't even care about Amazon as a sales channel. There's an opportunity for a bunch of people who sell a bunch of AirPod looking headphones to rank for the AirPod keywords and get all that traffic that's going to Amazon with their wallets open with the intent to go buy wireless headphones. They don't really see the Apple ones. I guess I'll just buy something else that's only $20. So that's one example. But basically, when I'm looking at competition, kind of the first thing I'd look at is pull the VIRALAUNCH or Jungle Scout or whatever your sales estimation software choice is and figure out exactly kind of how big the pie is as a whole on the first, say, two pages of sales and of the few keywords you want to go after. And then also who has how much of each slice. And if you go into a market and everyone has 10% market share of the monthly sales, then you know you can go in there and you might be able to slide in there, steal 0.5% for everyone. You can have 10% real quickly. And then it's not that bad of a marketplace, where if you go into other ones, you can find some niches where the top listing has 80% of sales and then the 20% of sales is split up between the next 20 listings after it. That's the kind of marketplace where I doubt you're going to be able to take too much from the 80% market share company. And then if you're stuck with the last 20% competing with 20 other sellers, you're kind of in a niche that's doomed from the beginning. Those are the kind of things I think about when I first look from a 10,000 foot view at competition and figuring out, is this niche competitive or not? Is how much is the market share split up and how much can I kind of take for myself?
Super smart. And I'm really glad to hear you say that. So I spoke to Kevin King the other day. He's another person. He's got a very good overview way of thinking, although he's very numbers driven, but you know, he's also got a real sort of street smarts in this stuff. And it's quite reassuring to hear that, because I've been telling people for ages that they really need to respect the market share thing that you're referencing. And the reason I have the courage to say that is we see that coming up a lot in the 10K Collective Mastermind, where the people who are killing it and really they're aggressively growing their business and cash flow positive very much dominate their markets. And people who struggle or just disappear from the mastermind because they can't really make it work are the people who've got me too products, where they end up owning a pathetic part of the marketplace. And it really comes down to that star principle, doesn't it, by Richard Koch, who I'm glad to say is a Brit, which is unusual in the online sort of business space. But the star principle is from the Boston Consulting Group Matrix. Very, very simple idea, but very poorly implemented, which is you want to go after things where you can be the number one in a niche and it's growing fast. And there's so many fast growing niches on Amazon, like you just pointed out, AirPods, which probably didn't exist as a niche four years ago ever anywhere. But if you are like bringing up the rear, and somebody has 50% of the market, they can get all the economies of scale. They are the preferred provider, so they can probably get a higher price point. They got all the social proof from reviews and stuff, and the ranking in itself is social proof, right, near the top of page one. So it's impossible to beat. So yeah, it's really great to hear you say that, because it's what I've been banging on about for the last couple of years and really seeing successes and failures on that basis as well. And I think it's something that is completely ignored by most people because, as you say, you don't see that information given, not explicitly anyway, in VIRALAUNCH or Jungle Scout or whatever.
And we see it from this point of view too, where brands come to us and want their sales to increase on Amazon. And where we get to a point where we tell them, hey, we got the 85% market share. There's nothing we can do. We're an Amazon-only agency. We don't do social media marketing. We don't do email blasts. We don't do any of the kind of off-Amazon marketing. And that now you're at the point where you just need to make the pie bigger as a whole. We've done our part on Amazon. We'll conserve your 85% market share and hold on to that as long as possible. And we're doing our job, but now it's your job to make the pie bigger as a whole, because there's only so much traffic on Amazon. We're constantly maxing out our ad spend and trying to figure out different ways to spend advertising dollars, because we've maxed out the entire kind of pie within our Amazon ecosystem. And it's always kind of shocking when you figure out how small the pie actually is sometimes.
Yeah, that isn't something you hear of so much, because I mean, most companies don't have the cash to, you know, maximize either to fund the inventory needs, or if they do, then to fund the advertising needs as well, which can be pretty substantial. But yeah, that's an interesting point. So there can be a problem of maxing out the pie. But I think that's a real quality problem to have, because you know, you may want to make more sales, but the sales you've got are going to be defensible and profitable compared to spreading yourself incredibly thin and having 10% of Amazon and like 5% of the sales on eBay, and then, you know, whatever percentage of the high street sales, right?
Yep. And then that's when it comes back to the psychology too, of just how many people are buying a hammer on Amazon every month. And is there anything we can do to actually encourage people to buy more hammers, or is it just a need basis and there's nothing we can do about it? Because at that point, we should really be optimizing for like profit margin, that type of thing. Because even if we get our brand in front of more people, if we're not going to expand our SKU count past just the few hammers we sell, then we're basically stuck. And so then that's, again, like one thing I'd look at when I'm looking at the competition, seeing at how big is their catalog. Are they looking to launch more SKUs in the future, or are they just focusing on their two SKUs that they have for the last 10 years? Because if they're focused on their two SKUs and they're never going to budge off those two SKUs, I don't really want to compete with them. I want to compete with someone who's growing their SKU count and maybe will forget about some of their older SKUs they created in the past.
Interesting. So really the people that are easiest to compete with are the people who are expanding their catalog and just kind of abandoning their older products. Is that right?
Yeah, my brother has a couple hundred thousand SKUs, and you easily could steal the buy box from him 90% of the time on one of his SKUs, and he wouldn't even notice. But if you steal 90% of the buy box from someone who has two SKUs, obviously they notice the second happens.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, yeah. Do you say your brother has 200,000 SKUs now? That's Andrew, right?
Yeah. He has a bunch of like hardware and B2B companies that have like a bunch of like spare parts, stuff like that. So he'll just like upload an entire catalog, and it has like 10 Filipinos helping him do this Excel spreadsheets and the feeds.
Yeah. So that's interesting. I mean, so that there's, as you were talking about business models, I mean, I think people get very confused between Amazon as a sales channel, Amazon as a marketing channel, Amazon as a fulfillment channel, all of which you can be, or you can split it into those bits, but also it's not a business model. And people get confused about that, but I guess because a lot of us come into it, and I was the same, from a non-business background or some marketing. I'd done online marketing stuff, but yeah, we don't really come in thinking clearly about business models as a separate thing from channel, right? But it strikes me that the more I learn, and especially you're in the position, that there are lots of different business models. So tell us a little bit more about that. How would you sort of classify the business models that operate within the Amazon space, or use it as part of their model?
A quick example, kind of tangent, but kind of on the same subject as that, is imagine that you see a product that you're competing with that is on sale 50% off. And you go and look at their seller account and you see that they're selling 200,000 listings. You can kind of assume that they can care less about that brand and that they're just trying to liquidate old goods, or they're just trying to move this quickly because they got this for a cheap price. And so right there, I would try to order, say, like 99 from them, just to see how many they have in stock, to see if they're going to be continuously selling this at 50% off, or if they're just trying to liquidate something quickly. Where if I looked at, say, another competitor and they're 50% off, and I look at their seller account and that's the only product they sell, then I'd assume that they're basically going out of business. It's kind of a different thing to think about when you kind of look at their catalog size and think about what their company's doing. When you have one SKU and everything's 50% off, that's probably not a very good sign. So I don't know if you have any comments on that, but that kind of explains the business models a little bit. But the main business models that I see are, it's a private labeler who listens to podcasts and keeps on top of all the trips and tricks and tips. And they're tough to compete with because they care a lot about all the different hacks, and they usually have minimal amount of SKUs that they focus a lot of attention on. There's actual brands that sell in brick and mortar store, where Amazon is maybe 5-10% of their total revenue. But it's something that they're interested in. They know it's growing, but at the same time, they don't really care too much. And they're definitely not willing to burn any bridges anywhere else to help Amazon out. And then we also see now more and more B2B and like manufacturing companies that are used to selling through a million different sales channels to get to the end customer. And now they're thinking about, for the first time, cutting out all those different middlemen, sales reps, and selling direct to the customer. And that's kind of where our agency specializes and tends to have a lot of clients, is in the realm of companies doing B2C for the very first time. And so it's kind of interesting, but also pretty scary cultural change for a lot of these companies.
So you guys specialize really in then helping these the latter sort of group of people then the most, right? So they're B2B and they're getting used to the direct to consumer thing, so that the sales channels have fundamentally changed, or you know, the nature of them have changed so much that they're now doing B2C, and that's what you guys specialize in, right?
Yep, and they have to debate internally, is Amazon something that the marketing department's going to handle, the sales department's going to handle, are both going to handle it and they're going to take turns on it, or how are they going to handle this internally, and then how are the sales going to be collected, and how are they going to incorporate it into their 40-year-old accounting software, and all these kind of questions that a lot of Amazon consultants don't want to go anywhere near. One of the big issues that we encounter with these kind of B2B companies that are trying B2C for the first time is that they're not even fully aware of who has kind of what roles in the Amazon field. They don't know if it's the marketing department's job. They don't know if it's the sales department's job. They should work together, whose advertising budget it should be taken out of, how the inventory management system is going to sync up with Amazon, how they're going to account for different taxes now that they have Nexus in a bunch of different states, a bunch of different questions like that, that more than not, the Amazon consultants out there just don't want to handle them, and we have no problem handling them. I see why they don't want to handle them, because solving those problems don't really scale. There's no like software or anything easy. You just have to talk to people a lot. But it's something that, coming from my original story of working for my family's company and then eventually kind of turning that company into a totally different thing, kind of resonates with a lot of these companies. And we've gone through a lot of the pain points culture-wise of teaching people how to kind of reinvent their company. And so we feel totally comfortable doing that, where other agencies don't really want to go near those culture changes.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. And I think the main thing that strikes me there is that it's unusual to have had that culture shift and be an Amazon consultant, as you said. I mean, a lot of the time it seems like people have an actually pretty solid background in, I don't know, software engineering or engineering. It seems like the engineers, like Casey at Viral Launch, is obviously a super smart guy, really lovely as well. I mean, just very calm person. So like Greg Mercer, very positive person who's just fantastic at systems. But the fact is, they came from a sort of systems or software or engineering background and then got into Amazon and then quickly thought, I can put these two together. Whereas you've gone a bit of the journey that there's a couple of guys in the 10K Collective Mastermind that are run in London, actually. It's not as unusual as you might think that there's one person who's like eighth generation family business and has fought his family for about 10 years to bring the business, first of all, not sell B2B, selling to big box retailers, but to bring it direct to consumer and to start with their own website, and then, of course, Amazon much, much more recently. And then there's somebody else who's in the early stages of that, and you can see him sweating with the effort of changing. And he's like fourth generation of his family business, so it's like 100 years of tradition of one way of doing it. And you can see him sweating to kind of get his head around it. It is a really big culture shift. And I think those of us who come straight into Amazon don't have any of the supply chain expertise that he has, or the production, or the brand that he's built. But at least we're not carrying that baggage. It can be quite heavy baggage, can't it? I mean, how do you deal with moving people on from that?
And that's the deal, is that it's usually more upper management than lower management who is hesitant. Usually we get someone who was, Amazon was just kind of thrown on their desk one day saying, hey, figure out the Amazon problem. And they start looking into it, and the more they research it, the more they realize they know nothing and that this is kind of its own monster. And so they go and Google Amazon consultant and find us. More times than not, that person who initially Googled us, like, loves us, wants to hire us, is our champion. And then it's working with that person to explain to like their board of directors or their CEO that they need an Amazon consultant to get this under control, because there's no way they can do this by themselves. And so it's interesting, because usually like the lower level employees are all for us coming in, helping them do their jobs better. And it's more from the kind of older strategic point of view, where if you have some CEO who's say 55, 60 years old, and they got 3 more years, 4 more years until they're out the door, last thing they want to do is change the entire business model. They'd rather just conserve for the last few years before they head out.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And yeah, that is a problem, isn't there? It's sort of a non-alignment of interest. And I guess it's one of the realities with even, you know, quite a smallest business, even, you know, the smallest number being two, if you've got a business partners, just like in a marriage, I guess it's the same thing, that just because you're basically going the same direction doesn't mean everything is aligned. You know, the interests of one person may not be. So, and particularly, yeah, an older CEO is not the same as an owner-founder who's hungry for the business. I mean, Jeff Bezos is in his 50s, but he's very prepared to change a lot, although it'd be interesting to see, you know, as and when some upstart company comes up against Amazon in 10 years' time, you know, or 5 years' time, or maybe it's growing right now. But there are some cultures where the CEO is very, very aggressive about change, but that's probably pretty unusual, right? I mean, is that your experience as well? I mean, how common is it that people are resistant versus open to the change there?
The way it's been described to me is that, yeah, there's the growers and the founder kind of CEO type people who you can hire as a CEO down the line if you need kind of to revamp everything because they can grow and build stuff. And then you get like the professional CEO who just manages and can do everything conservatively. And every once in a while, you get a Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk or Steve Jobs type dude who can be a professional CEO and conserve, but at the same time, come out with crazy new ideas and take the right bets all the time. But those are obviously don't happen very often. Usually you're more one or the other. And I can tell you that, like, specifically my co-founder and I of my consulting firm, he's more of the conservative side. I'm more of the kind of creative side, and we work well together, but definitely we're not both amazing at both skills, and that's a pretty rare thing to have. And so dealing with companies out there, rarely do we talk to a CEO or some executive where they're super, super sharp and it's like, oh man, this guy totally gets it. This guy has a vision. This guy has going places. He's crazy. It's more times than not, you're just talking to your friend's dad.
Yeah, makes sense. And yeah, partly it's a generational thing, I guess, isn't it? I mean, it seems to be linked with that. I'm not trying to be sort of ageist. I mean, I know some very good sellers who are older, but yeah, it's more likely that if somebody's younger, they get the internet, but then of course they have the problem of not understanding the value of building, you know, decent quality products and a brand that lasts for more than 5 seconds, I guess, is the opposite problem,
exactly.
Right? Yeah.
No,
okay.
Exactly.
So tell me a bit more.
Well, I just end with a, Our generations are obsessed with hacks and such, and their generation too is more the generation before us and more willing just to put in the hard work and just do the hard thing. So that's always kind of a interesting cultural thing too.
Yeah, and I suppose I'm 45, so I'm right in between the two. And it's interesting that actually, because what you just said, I mean, I know you're in your, what, late 20s now, I guess, I'm 45, and then some of the CEOs are sort of in their 50s or 60s. And I guess that I'm less excited by hacks than a lot of the young people seem to be, and that I'm never going to be the person on YouTube getting a million hits going, here's the latest hack and look at me, I've just made $1 million overnight. I mean, that I've not done it. I can't see myself ever doing that either, but I don't think that's the value I bring. So I think it's a blend for me of strategy and hacks, and hacks and tactics need to fit within a strategic objective for a particular department or a particular push or a particular type of channel. And then with that, that sits within a sort of overall objective of the business over the next 10 years and whatever, as far as I'm concerned. So it's interesting, isn't it, that actually I think all good businesses need a blend of the two, and most people tend to fall on one side or the other. And I'm definitely not a particularly hack seat type person, and I realize I get a bit bored of that because it just has such a short shelf life, really. But so talking of how people see it, I mean, how you're talking about types of CEOs, can you generalize a bit more about how bigger companies see Amazon, or is it just kind of vary company to company?
It tends to be very company to company. Some just want to get Amazon under control just to get their, all they care about Amazon is their minimum advertised pricing. I talked to a company last week that has minimum advertised pricing only because of Amazon. That's what got them to instill the policy. And so the amount of brands we talked to who just basically only care about minimum advertised pricing is shocking. And for you people who may not know, minimum advertised pricing is this kind of like fictitious standard retail price that companies put out there, that this is a price they prefer the product to be sold at. In the US, at least, it's illegal for them to actually tell you what price to sell the product at. If they try to like sue you for saying that you need to sell for a specific price, that's actually against the law. It's called price fixing. And so it's something that is kind of a hush-hush thing. So that's why when you go to a store, all Apple products always cost the same amount of money no matter what, is because they have minimum advertised pricing. And they basically threaten Target and Walmart and such, saying, hey, if you guys don't sell this at this specific price, we're never going to sell you Apple products again. And you really don't want that to happen. And so they're able to kind of like under the table, bully people into a certain pricing. And since you can't really bully people on Amazon due to the buy box
a lot of brands just want to get that under control. And so they don't really care about if the sales revenue goes up or down or anything like that. They just want their price under control because all their brick and mortar stores are complaining to them that it's being sold for so cheaply on Amazon. And so that's kind of an interesting cultural change compared to the private label sellers who can kind of really care less about all that kind of stuff and just would never compete for the buy box in the first place since their supply chain is so basic and boring.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And by the way, this is a very similar thing in the European Union, which UK is still in at the moment, which is RRP, recommended retail price, exactly like MAP. I mean, in theory, just in the EU, it's illegal to have a monopoly or even state support for a lot of things. And very similar to America, like in theory, it's one thing. And in practice, it's exactly the same thing. If Asda, like, or Walmart, Asda, which I think is even part of Walmart, gets, you know, starts selling BIC biros for, I don't know, 10 pence per packet when it should be 50 pence, and BIC's simply going to turn around to them and say, look, we're not going to supply you with these. And I guess you can't legally oblige somebody to supply somebody with things. And there's probably lots of complicated legal arguments. But yeah, you know, the fact is that understandably, they're trying to maintain price because of their relationship with the retail stores. So tell me a bit more about, I mean, everyone wants to keep a decent price, but there's that particular tension that people have or businesses have that sell to brick and mortar and sell to direct to consumer in general, and more specifically on Amazon. So how do companies, I mean, as you've mentioned one aspect of it, what are the other aspects that come up driven by that sort of relationship between brick and mortar and direct to consumer stuff?
To a lot of our clients, the Amazon fee structure is very confusing. They're used to kind of more of a vendor central business model, where they get purchase orders from Target and Walmart. And sometimes they get like some of these purchase orders like quarterly. So they just get these really big purchase orders and they ramp up for one big purchase order, sell it off to Walmart, and then count their money and wait for the next purchase order to come in. And so they, the fees, paying for the advertising so directly, I think some companies get kind of intimidated by how transparent all the numbers actually are and that how simple it is sometimes to just really calculate down exactly how much profit margin we're making off each unit and that we should spend more money on advertising. And other companies get more intimidated because they have very complicated things where they have to ship items to two warehouses before they send them into FBA, and they have to calculate all these different shipping prices in to figure out what the exact profit margin is. And they're not used to sending in inventory and it not being actually sold yet, and it sells once each individual customer buys it. And like that type of thing really kind of throws them for a loop. They're very used to selling to these traditional brick and mortar stores, have that settled and figured out for the last 40 years. And the Amazon having a totally different business model, different way of shipping things, labeling things, really throws them for a wrench. And for a lot of companies, it's very, very intimidating. And once we get on the phone with them for like 2 hours straight explaining kind of everything, they usually walk away with it being a lot more comfortable because it's actually not near that bad. Like you said, you've talked to dozens and dozens and dozens of people who have sold stuff on Amazon. And if they can figure it out, I'm sure some multinational corporation can figure it out.
Absolutely. Listen, some of the people that I've worked with who managed to sell stuff online, you know, they can do it. Anybody in the world could do it. I mean, without being
foolish. I have a 15-year-old student from my high school class I teach that he had borrowed his mom's credit card. He sells on Amazon and sends stuff into the fulfillment center. So if he can do it when he doesn't even have a driver's license, I'm sure you guys can do it.
Yeah. Having said that, though, to be fair to them, I mean, you've got to – one of the issues that I'm realizing as you scale up any kind of business, even with amazing FBA, which are my main focus these days, like yourself on a much more modest scale, this sort of consulting side rather than selling side at the moment anyway. But whichever it is, it doesn't matter whether it's consulting or – Amazon selling or anything else, you've got to figure out ways to handle complexity. And I was just having a team meeting and I'm like, guys, thank you for making the time. I know that it feels like you don't need to be here for half of it, but the issue is coordination. I think that's like 80% of the job. So to be fair, if you have, you know, 2,000, 10,000 SKUs and you've got to track where they physically are, how much inventory you've got, how much inventory you're going to need, and do the cash flow forecast for that, and then work out the logistics, and then do the accounting, you know, what you've actually spent on it. To be fair to them, that is a just monster-sized job, right? It's not a casual thing to change that. I mean, what are the processes that you see people successfully implementing in terms of their overall business structure? I mean, obviously, you don't take responsibility for their overall business, but I guess you've got to help them integrate Amazon into their structures. What would you say are the biggest issues and the big solutions on the big scale solutions?
So one of the big
issues that we run into is anytime a company has a extremely old like inventory management system that especially doesn't have ties to any APIs. Because there's so much awesome Amazon software out there that costs like 15, 20, 30, 40 bucks a month that like these big brands can care less about spending that kind of money on it. And if someone like TaxJar is going to make their life easier, they're going to spend that money in a half second. But if TaxJar can't properly link into like their personal accounting system, then it's kind of all for naught. And so we have one company I can think of specifically that like way back when 50 years ago, they used to sell a lot of just like plain lumber, like just 2x4s and wood and such. And that their inventory management system, since they didn't want to switch over how many decades ago, they're now kind of using a lumber management system to manage their inventory of their entire publicly traded company. And none of the stuff actually lines up and it doesn't make any sense. And they still think like the system still thinks you're selling lumber, but you're really selling, say, power tools or whatever. And it's like, such a mess to kind of get a company like that organized opposed to some company that just uses ShipStation and just has all their APIs already set up and has a modern company. That's a breeze.
Makes a great deal of sense. And I think what it comes down to is, again, it's a more general business building / adjusting discipline, right? Set of strategies. And there's a really brilliant book that I'm really sort of not just absorbing, but trying to just sort of program into my head called Scaling Up by Vern Harnish, which is a really fantastic book because it's geared to highly scaling companies, not necessarily publicly held corporations like Jim Collins discusses in Great by Choice and all that. They are really, really great books, all the Jim Collins and Jim Porteous, all that stuff. But this is so actionable and yet it's not simplistic. And the real reason that you can't be simplistic in your business planning, in my experience, even at the tiniest level, like the stuff that I'm doing and some of the more serious and aggressive scaling companies, is exactly that future proofing thing. Just because you kick can down the road a little bit for the quarter or for the year is okay. But if you kick it for 5 years and you have a really ridiculous disconnect between a system and the sort of thing that the system is there to manage, like a lumber management system managing, you know, sports shoes or something, then that's really going to come and bite you in the bum so hard at some point. You don't even necessarily know when, because you might be in 1990 updating your software or not updating it. You don't know that Amazon's going to be big. It doesn't exist yet. But the fact that something like Amazon's going to come along and need it is one of those things that you can kind of predict. You see what I mean? It's like a business strategic way of thinking versus just doing things in a rigid way for 50 years.
Well, and the sad part is too, we get some of these people set up on Shopify, ShipStation, everything. Not only will everything run that much smoother and be automated and easy and have great APIs, but also they probably won't be spending whatever 50 grand a year they are for whatever hosted web service they have now for their shopping cart. You know what I'm saying? Like, I guarantee not only are these old softwares are using clunky, but I bet they're very expensive too.
Yeah, it's a bit like Moore's Law with the processing that they created for at Intel, right? That the processing power sort of doubles roughly every 18 months. And I think, yeah, the cost of any given software type activity or computational linked activity that you used to have a team of accountants and a bunch of calculators, or before that, my grandfather used to work in a bank and there were no calculators, a bunch of guys with probably slide rules and just pieces of paper and pens and a lot of late nights. You know, I mean, the cost of that computation tends to come down shockingly large amounts every few years and certainly every decade. So yeah, it makes sense. I mean, if nothing else, it's a sort of having to go through the Amazon sort of thing is probably a microcosm or just like a small thin end of the wedge for a process they probably should have been forced to do decades ago by the sound of it anyway. I mean, is that your experience?
Oh, for sure. It's one of the times where they have to now organize their entire catalog, have it all in one place, have all their images in one place. And that's the thing is that we work with some companies and like the second we sign up with them, they're able to send us a spreadsheet with all their UPCs, pricing, images, everything within a half second. And other companies, they're like, oh man, it's going to take me a bit to get all these assets together. And it just kind of shows you what the company is going to be like working with moving forward for sure.
I can really understand why nobody else is bothering to do this, because obviously it's almost like a quixotic quest that you're taking the guys who are stuck in a really not just pre-Amazon or even pre-internet or pre-direct-to-consumer way of operating, but just not a very integrated type of company in terms of their information systems anyway. And, you know, bringing them into the 21st century, never mind onto Amazon.
Well, and then you jungle scout these brands and see that their listings are doing $250,000 each a month in sales. And you're going, well, what the heck? We need to get this going ASAP kind of thing, where if somehow lucked themselves into having a sweet brand after 50 years of having this family business or something. I don't know. But it's crazy some of these companies we talk to where for one reason or another, people just love their brand.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. It's like a question of not throwing the baby out of the bathwater either. I mean, again, I'm going to reference one of the members of the 10K Collective Mastermind, like fourth generation selling a very niche type of product, obviously not going to break any confidentiality about what it is, but it's not that exciting. I guess it's not like a fashion trend thing. It's not trending on Twitter and hasn't been any time in the last few decades. And so he came into the room of the mastermind saying, wondering about getting out of this market niche. It seems a bit boring. And we are like, holy, you know, Batman, you've got a massive brand here. You've got a great expertise in the production side. You've got a ton of stock for starters, and you've got all the supply chain set up. And, you know, it's not a question of changing who you are and having an identity crisis. It's like, but you need to have the identity crisis of the right kind. It's like you still sell XYZ widget. It's just that, or XYZ for the Americans. It's just that now you're going to do it direct to consumer. So in a way, I think it comes down to articulating the brand even stronger. I mean, one of the brick and mortar kind of things that you had, and I'd like to talk to this, is say you're selling, VZ Biros, right? And then actually he's selling it online as Biros R Us or something. So there's a bit of a conflict there because he's selling it under the sort of real brand, as it were, of the company, family business, on brick and mortar stores, and they're selling on Amazon as something different. He's getting to that awkward point where he's going to have to decide almost between really annoying the brick and mortar sellers and being, you know, fully competitive on Amazon versus fighting with one hand behind his back. Is that a process you've seen in your consulting?
Yep. And sometimes we are able to kind of come to some sort of truce with some of the resellers and say, hey, you guys sell these SKUs, we'll sell those SKUs. Sometimes brands just want to come out with a whole new category of their product. So it's just all of their SKUs, but then it's dash AMZ. And they have basically, it's the same exact SKU they sell on Target or Walmart, but they come out with an Amazon version so no one bugs them. And they are the only ones who have control of that SKU. And they don't distribute it to anyone else. No one bugs them about pricing. That always seems kind of the best way to do it. But yeah, there's a bunch of different kind of ways to get around it or work with it. But it's, it tends to be a problem for most people for sure.
Yeah, it is a problem. So repackaging and rebranding the existing SKUs is probably, as you said, the most elegant solution, because you kind of retain your brand and you kind of retain the catalog. Although it does strike me that really sooner or later, it's a business model decision. At least that's my perception, because there is a massive tension between those two. Is that your perception, or do you think it's a longer term sustainable thing?
My mission at our company is to get rid of all middlemen. Okay. I think they kind of just all are just a waste. Don't really add too much value along to the supply chain. And the ones that do are actually adding value because they're getting the product in a unique area that's hard to get to or something like that. But for the most part, yeah, I don't want to compete with them. I would rather just be the only seller. If you're creating the product from scratch, you should get all the value that you created for your brand. And we've gotten to the point before with brands where we've sent out kind of the mass email to all the wholesalers saying, hey, just so you guys know, October 1st, no longer anyone's allowed to sell on Amazon. We have people selling on Amazon, people selling below MAP pricing, and we just can't have that anymore. So if you're stocking our products on the shelves and showing them to customers and adding value to our brand, letting customers touch the product and such, keep doing what you're doing. We love what you're doing. Keep your brick and mortar store open. If you're buying our stuff and reselling it on Amazon, you're not really adding any value to our brand. It's something that we can do normally, and that your time's up. I apologize, but it's true. And so to prevent them from just kind of liquidating the product and tanking your brand, you give them whatever, 2 to 6 months, depending on how much inventory they have in stock, lead time to let them know that, hey, 2 months from now is our last purchase order. 4 months from now, no more selling on Amazon.
Makes a lot of sense. And so you're basically giving notice, because as you say, people got to add value. I mean, in the end, the market isn't going to sustain anyone who's doing any activity that doesn't add value. because why would it? It's got to show up in the economics, particularly in a very transparent world where there is, if you like, very perfect markets or quite liquid and transparent markets. So like you've had on the stock exchange for years is now coming to retail, right? I guess that's one of no coincidence that Jeff Bezos used to work on Wall Street, right? I mean, he wasn't a guy in his college dorm room creating a company a la Zuckerberg, right? So he was on Wall Street. Mm. I think he was an options trader or something, wasn't he? But he was certainly very sharp, very, very sharp about allocation of capital and value and all the rest of it in a very transparent market. And in a sense, you could say he brought some of that way of thinking, that way of operating to retail, I guess. I've not really made the connection before, but now you've said that, I'm like,
yeah. That's my kind of thought, is that without getting too out there, is that in a perfect market, everything is the same price to everyone always. And that the only variable is just the shipping. So like in a perfect world, whatever, it should cost me the same amount of money to buy a can of Coke in China as it does in US, as it does in Paris, as it does in South Africa. It's just that the shipping should be the only thing from where it was made to where it's shipped to should be the only thing that's variable on it. And I think eventually, hopefully, with everything getting digitized and such, eventually we'll get there.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, yeah, it's an interesting ideal to have. I mean, in a way, it's quite a sort of economist's way of looking at life. Like you're after a sort of intellectual ideal. But yeah, I mean, certainly from a practical point of view, it's interesting that you're saying basically you think people need to choose. And yeah, as you say, there is a certain type of consumer and there probably always will be. I mean, we're not going to get 100% penetration of retail by e-commerce ever. But if somebody needs to physically touch a product in your retail store, provides that experience for your brand and your products, I guess they're adding value. And then if they don't add the value and all they're doing is flog it on Amazon, they're just adding to the competition and the mess, right? So that's not really
good. Yeah, if you're just one more person clicking, I have this product, I add, or I think it says, click this to sell this product to, or something like that. If you're just doing that, you're not really adding too much value compared to actually having your brick and mortar store and advertising your brick and mortar store and getting foot traffic in there and selling on the product. But back on kind of last subject and kind of tie a bow on all this, is interesting with, we have Best Buy headquartered here in Minneapolis, and they do a really aggressive price matching with Amazon. So even if all the customers aren't online in the distant future, we still could get to a point where all prices are the exact same.
Because that makes sense, because otherwise people are just going to start using stores to do what they already do, which is that they'll go into I've got a Waterstones around the corner from me, which is a nice bookshop in the UK, and it's very civilized, and they've got a cafe in there, and they have nice selection of books, and they have reasonably knowledgeable staff compared to Amazon seller central support anyway, and which is a low bar, and they have coffee and stuff. But so many people go into places like that, they'll look at the books and then they'll just get the phone out, go on Amazon and just buy it cheaper. So if you don't compete on price sooner or later, as you said, there's the shipping thing, you know, it's not going to be a very sustainable price model because everyone's doing it. It's just standard consumer behavior that's it's impossible to legislate against, right?
Yeah. And if shipping's only variable and you can ship 30 big screen TVs to one Best Buy location and get economies of scale, and if on Amazon I have to buy each one individually and ship it individually to my household, eventually Best Buy wins that price war.
Okay, just tell me a bit more about that, the economics of that. I haven't quite followed that.
So imagine basically TV has to be sold for the same price everywhere because everyone just price matches everyone else, and it basically gets to a point where the market's perfect and TVs cost this much money. So then it's going to come down to the only thing that's variable is going to be the shipping, where if the TV's in Chicago, it's going to cost me more to ship it to Minneapolis than if I lived in Chicago. Oh, yeah, just real quick. Yeah, so the TV is going to be slightly more expensive for me because I'm slightly further away and slightly more gas to get it to me. But if, say, like a Best Buy store can order 20 TVs at once at the same exact price as Amazon's getting them, but they can have me kind of subsidize the shipping by picking it up in the store and doing the last mile myself, opposed to Amazon having to actually pay for the last mile, eventually Best Buy could actually win the price war. The only reason people win the price war against Best Buy currently is because people violate MAP for the most part, and they got some crazy deal on the product.
Yeah, that makes sense. And the thing is also, there goes retail arbitrage as a business model, talking of business models on Amazon that do and don't work. So yeah, and there is it.
Retail arbitrage retail arbitrage are like the foot soldiers marching us towards the perfectly balanced
market. Yeah, I like it. Well, I'm glad I hope they see themselves as fulfilling that economic mission, you know. Nice I'm just making a note of that because there's a nice little quote, which a lot of charge of the foot shoulders marching us towards a perfectly balanced market. I like it. And I guess as the market becomes more balanced, then that retail arbitrage opportunity is going to get less and less, right? I mean, would you agree with that? What's your view on retail arbitrage as a business model over the next couple of years?
Yeah, retail arbitrage will turn into something like people who go to garage sales and look for deals, where it's like, yeah, I guess you can get rich every once in a while, but it's not a sustainable business model type of thing. Where it's like, I guess you can keep looking for that rare comic book that no one knows exists still, and you can go sell it on a marketplace. But yeah, I wouldn't want to. If someone told me that's what they're planning to do for the next 40 years of their life, I'd say good luck.
Yeah. And then again, it's a generational thing, isn't it? I mean, looking 40 years ahead is probably not something that anyone's doing very much these days, but certainly not in retail arbitrage. So tell me a little bit more, just to sort of wrap that up, because a business model is something you sort of opened with. Tell us a bit more about, broadly speaking, the business models. We talked about the business model of selling to brick and mortar and the fact that it conflicts with the direct consumer model. What are the variants, or I don't know if the word business model is even quite right, but what are the kinds of business models or patterns do you see that are in the, you know, the bigger picture of how people are making money or exploiting the opportunity on the Amazon channel or platform?
Yeah, I see it. It's only a few buckets. There's, yeah, like I said, the brand who sells in brick and mortar who also gets sold on Amazon. It might be the brand selling it, might not be the brand selling it. There's the private label sellers out there. There's the merchant fulfilled Chinese sellers out there who sell everything at bottom barrel prices, and you get the product 2 months from now. And I don't really know where they're going to go in the long term. They kind of just seem that they kind of pop up and get suspended the next day and pop up again. And then lastly, there is kind of like, yeah, like these B2B companies that people are selling their stuff on Amazon, but they don't really know who it is or what's going on really. And they're like an extra motor for your filter on your pool that you have at your house. And it's like this weird kind of B2B product that usually only pool installers would even know it existed 20 years from now. And you'd have to contact a pool installer who would contact a wholesaler who would order it from a catalog. Then they'd pick it up and install it 2 weeks later. Now you can just look up the model number and buy it directly on Amazon and just install it yourself with a quick YouTube video. And so stuff like that is going to be kind of like a big emerging trend, I think, moving forward, is less specialty people in things that don't really need specialty people, and more kind of home installers just kind of doing stuff themselves. I know it's not nearly as big over in Europe and the UK, the home improvement, Home Depot crowd, but it's obviously very large over here in the US. Everyone loves improving and maintaining their homes.
Yeah, and it's not as big in the UK. I think actually building your own home is quite a tradition in Germany, for example, because I spent some time in Germany, and that's obviously the second biggest Amazon market in the world after the US. So I do think that's pretty big. I don't know if it's so much home improvement as actually home creation in the first place, which is actually quite big. Knowing the Germans, they probably have a somewhat different structure of doing it, and it's probably more regulated because everything they do is that way. But I'm not a specialist in that. But it's an interesting point. I mean, I think that the business-to-business thing, that's another thing to point out really, that having, you know, what, just when some consumer goods companies have got used to going from B2B, so they sell from the people who own the rights to, or even own the factories to make a product, to brick and mortar, who then sell on to the end consumers. Just as those guys are getting used to selling directly to the consumer, business to business sales on Amazon's getting a real push from Amazon. They're really pushing that platform, aren't they? And so that you can integrate things like your tax number and invoices and what have you, and make it convenient for business to business. And apparently business to business sales as a percentage of sales in e-commerce are just about set to overtake business to consumer. So what's your take on the business to business thing via the Amazon platform?
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely interesting. I had a guy contact me from Amazon last week asking about business to business, saying, do you have a bunch of companies that would be interested in joining the Amazon business? I can help them organize their listings and get on Amazon, basically all the jobs that we do. But he could do it for free, and he'd do it from Amazon's side, which sounds appealing on one side. The only thing that stinks is that, like, we had one company that was sold like hardware for helping home builders and stuff do electrical things. The interesting thing was that they get to sign these deals with these builders that build, say, 2,500 homes at once in this huge housing development. And so they were thinking at first they wanted
all of their stuff to be in stock at Amazon and all their builders to buy their stuff through Amazon. And so we start kind of crunching the numbers and we go, okay, for this $500,000 purchase order, the first 14% right off the bat just goes out the door to Amazon fees. Like you're losing $70,000 right off the bat just to Amazon fees. Let's keep this in-house. Let's just do these deals off Amazon. There's no reason to bring this over to Amazon. And so the B2B thing on Amazon, they're going to have to really figure out their fee structure for that to actually make sense in the long run. Where if I'm trying to buy some extra ink for my printer, some extra reams of paper, something like that at Amazon B2B, and I'm not really buying them at economies of scale, I'm just buying whatever, three things of ink or something like that. Then the Amazon B2B gave me an extra 5% off or something like that for buying three cartridges. That's a fair use of it and whatever, but it's fairly limiting compared to the entire B2B market because the B2B market, like you said, probably is overtaking the B2C market just because of the large orders that are out there. And no one wants to pay 14%. They're sitting there trying to negotiate these B2B contracts on like a half percentage point, let alone give 14% right out the door just for the ease of using Amazon's website.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between business to business and business to consumer, I would say, is that I was about to say, I mean, maybe it's one of those artificial distinctions. I mean, Vern Harnish, again, who I respect a lot in the Scaling Up book, said there's two artificial distinctions made in business models. One is between products and services, because all products companies eventually add services because it's more profitable. So you've moved from one to the other. And all service businesses eventually add products because they're more scalable. So like the consultants who create the SaaS stuff. So we'll see what you're doing in 5 years' time, the software as a service thing. But the other one is B2C and B2B. But I have to say, from my sort of, I'm not Vern Harnish, I'm not as clever, but it does look to me that it works in different drivers, because although everything's ultimately emotional sale because we're all humans, but the emotional driver in business is looking sharp and clever because you saved half a percentage point off a £10 million deal, which is still worth saving because that's, you know, quite a bit of money. Yeah, given that, it's not as impulse driven. It's not about convenience and speed. It's much more about the numbers. As you say, I think there's going to need to be a much more profound shift on Amazon. Because like you, I've always looked at that and I thought, if I was purchasing manager for something and I went on Amazon and just bought, you know, 10 of something, it wouldn't matter. But if I bought 10,000 units, I'd probably be fired because that would be such bad value. So I can't really see them, anyone taking it seriously unless they create a kind of separate platform or really separate rules or something. I mean, where do you see that going?
Yeah, I see it from the point of view of we are trying to sell some random widget on the internet. The internet is so vast and large, we're never going to be able to get our widget to be found. But we are willing to give up 14% of our retail price to be found and found by a person with their credit card saved, their shipping address saved type of thing. Where in these B2B companies, I don't think they're trying to be found nearly as much. I think a lot of them, everyone knows who the three brands are and they just negotiate between those three brands. It's not as much discovery, where Amazon really helps with discovery. None of these people who you talk to could start a private label brand without Amazon because the discovery thing was so important to them and they'll sacrifice that 14%, no problem for the discovery aspect. Where if you're selling $10 million worth of faucets, there's only three other companies that sell that many plumbing accessories in the UK. And it's fairly simple to figure out who they are by just Googling.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that is a profound difference between the two. So I mean, it's interesting that argument, which is probably a bit like in business schools, you know, how many angels dance on the head of the pin, is B2B versus B2C profoundly different. Yeah, maybe not ultimately, but I think you're right. I mean, that discovery thing, I think the thing is, once you create a very specialized product, but at a very high scale, it only makes sense for a certain, the market's only going to support quite a small number of businesses doing that, right? There's a big consolidation. So like, I don't know, steel pins for riveting together airplanes. I mean, there's probably some supplier that supplies Boeing. There's probably another couple of competitors that supply Boeing or something, but they probably only have them there just to keep them entertained because that's a very consolidated industry, right? So yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting space to watch, but I think what we're saying in conclusion is probably if you're a B2B seller, then Amazon is not going to be the holy grail for you anytime soon.
No, definitely not. It's and I think it's just types of B2B. I think it's there's B2B where we worked with a company in the past that sold labor law posters. So they sell a poster that has all the different labor laws on it that in the US you're mandated to have inside your small business. So that's kind of a sweet little B2B company because traditionally they had to buy this poster through like this work supply company catalog. And now they can, this business can just easily buy it on Amazon. And that's kind of a different B to like, it's like B to small B,
type of thing is a totally different business than B2B, where a hotel is buying a bunch of bed frames, 5,000 bed frames from a bed frame company. That's a totally different type of B2B. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like a B2B enterprise versus like a B2B small business.
Yeah, that's true. That's very interesting. That's a good distinction, actually. I mean, maybe that's why a lot of these generalizations are a little bit crude, because, yeah, the sizes of businesses and the way they operate is profoundly different. There's if you're like a solopreneur or got a tiny, like a mom and pop business, I guess, then there's somebody I know that sells accessories in the food space. And again, I'm trying to talk about the model without revealing the exact product. It can be tricky sometimes, but. And basically, that is the sort of thing that people do as a hobby, but it's the sort of thing that people also do in a sort of, not an industrial scale at all, but not even an enterprise scale, but just kind of as a sort of evenings and weekends or sort of part-time business, or maybe enough to help employ one person. And yeah, you're right, for that kind of thing. I mean, Amazon is a great place to buy, because again, they value time, because the number of units is so small, they wouldn't get any kind of decent deal from a traditional supply chain for B2B anyway. So in a way, they were never really catered for in the first place by existing systems, right?
Yeah, like B2B for you're buying accessories for your food truck, or B2B and you're buying accessories for NASA.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's like they're one, it's like, okay, I'm just looking for an industrial grade spatula and I'm looking for three of them within 2 days. And the other one's like, I need you to mechanically engineer this titanium nut and I need 30,000 of them.
Yeah. 30,000 titanium nuts, you know. Although I'm looking forward to having a little look on Amazon later this evening and see if I can find that, because there are some strange things on Amazon. It does have, what is it, 100 million SKUs, or maybe it's a lot more now. But I think titanium nuts may not be a big seller.
Whenever BuzzFeed gets bored, they usually search some weird thing and go, do you know you can buy houses for sale on Amazon? Do you know there's a life-size robot for sale on Amazon? And they always quote it as, Amazon's now selling a robot or now selling a house. And almost every time it's a third-party seller. And so, it's like you can put anything you want up on Amazon. Just get a quick PR boost.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good point, actually. I mean, for quick PR stunt, it's probably quite a good thing, but... Like I always say to people who are evaluating the market, just to bring that one to a close, and guess what? You can list anything you like for any price you like on Amazon. That doesn't mean anyone's going to buy it. Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for Kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.